I'm Greg Lance Watkins. I've been politically involved since I was about 14 in various pieces of politics. I was born in 1946. My father was, amongst other things, in military intelligence. So I've always had an awareness of military intelligence. He later spent the latter part of his career. One of his functions was working directly for the royal family on a personal basis as opposed to committee basis. He used to represent them on a number of their main charities. Margaret, the Queen Mother, the Queen, in particular. So I've always had a great awareness of it. I was opposed to Britain's membership of the European Union strongly in the days of Eden and Macmillan, and ever since. It was the worst move that Britain could ever have made. Even Winston Churchill was aware of it before the European Union was created. He knew that this was going on. He was all in favour of a European Union to try and bring an end to mainland rivalry and warfare and have one or two people only that one had to negotiate with instead of an entire rat bag full of people you were never sure who had the authority that week. But you may remember Churchill categorically stated, if the choice is joining with them or the deep blue sea, we must take to the sea immediately. He never favoured the idea of Britain having anything to do with it, but he did favour a European Union for the reason I've just given. I was out of the country from 70 through to 80, much of it travelling. I've had the great good fortune to visit some 60 or 70 countries, many of which I've lived in rather than in transit or purely a holiday. My first intelligent recorded in action was leaving Britain just after Christmas 1946, having persuaded my parents, because by then I was 11 months old, and it's very easy to persuade parents, that Britain was not the country to be in, my father having been a fighter pilot all the way through the war, fairly highly decorated, but with very few friends left because they'd all been killed. And we went to India, where we lived in Karachi. Then along came the partition, and the Liquid Ali Khan rather liked our house, so we were thrown out of India because we lived next door to the Gymkhana Club in Karachi. And we went to Switzerland for a while. I was a child. My father was BOAC Middle and Far East Grand Manager, BOAC being now British Airways, but in those days BOAC stood for Better on a Camel. Having left the Indian subcontinent, we then went to Switzerland for a while. My father investigated going to the Falklands, where they were looking for a pilot, and he went down there but decided not a good idea for technical reasons, and we ended up in Bahrain, where I was the first ever white child to live in Bahrain, and my father started a pump organisation fortuitously 3 months before the water table dropped 6 feet. So that was very successful. But then my education was coming up and stability, and he rejoined the Air Force and came back to Britain.
So anyway, look, you, what about you? Because you were educated at Clifton College in Bristol. What did you then go on to do?
I went immediately from there to Sandhurst. But I bought myself out of Sandhurst on two reasons. One, the British government had decided not to get involved in the Vietnam War, but we were fielding British troops with absolute knowledge of the government as advisors and participants, but I thought dishonourably they were wearing Australian uniforms because our parliament had said we wouldn't get involved.
The Americans didn't like that. Harold Wilson didn't want us to get involved.
Harold Wilson said he didn't want us to. Politicians rarely say the truth.
Okay, well, can you bring us up through your professional career a bit?
From Sandhurst, there were a couple of other reasons, and I left the British Army from choice. And then I have dedicated my life since then doing anything that would avoid work, because I was not fitted with a Puritan work ethic. For the last 30-odd years of my career, and I worked in South Africa, I was in South America, the States, etc.
Doing what?
Whatever was going. I sold computers back in the 1970s when a computer was about the size of a double-decker bus. They have got a bit smaller since. I was marketing. I had my own landscape gardening business. I employed anything up to 700 or 800 people, etc., etc. I wound up coming back to Britain. I worked for a company and disliked work in Britain, so I set up my own business with a second-hand and antiquarian bookshop dealing in also in collectibles, stamps, coins, medals, postcards, and banknotes in Chepstow. That meant that I had an income and meant that I didn't have to take work too seriously. And we were very much our own bosses. I did that until effectively about 2000. And then I got zapped with cancer. I've played with cancer on and off for 20-odd years. I've been told 3 times that I have 2 to 3 months to live, but I keep telling the consultants that...
Well, look, I have to interrupt you and ask you, you know, what do you put that down to? A lot of people, they're told that they've got some sort of terminal cancer, would be just simply worried, concerned, and also expect that they were going to die. So what would you say to anyone that comes across this whole idea of, well, you're about to die of cancer, what can you do about it?
I think the simple answer to that is, one, laugh at the vagaries of life. Treat it with an element of humour, because humour solves an awful lot of things. Two, don't let it bend you out of shape. Be your own kind of a person. Don't have an immediate personality change and get all worried about it. Don't sit there being concerned. Go for the treatments. Yes, I've had operations. I've had about 14 operations for cancer from having a kidney out, which was in 2001. I've had bladder cancer. I've had numerous operations for that. This has given rise to all sorts of problems. Luckily, not cancer with the prostate, because you keep prodding around with it, solving the problems of bladder cancer. It has a nasty habit of exciting the prostate, and it promptly grows to about four times the size it should be, which is a bit boring. I've had abdominal cancer. I've had lymphatic cancer, and then being bored with the cancer urology and chemotherapy and radiotherapy departments, etc., I thought I'd have a major heart attack. So I had one of those in 2012. But the one thing to do is treat the whole thing with humour, be totally philosophical about it, and remember to have a purpose in life, whatever it is. Mine was very much, I'm not prepared to die yet. There are far too many people left to annoy. And also, I have had on my website now for well over 20 years that I have cancer. I've put all of the gory details up, pour encourager les autres, and to show other people that you can survive it. And also, that was very cathartic for me, I freely admit.
Well, from a military intelligence angle, morale's quite important, isn't it, in winning?
It's everything. And if you've got a purpose, my website has always stated, I'm not remotely frightened of dying, but I'm determined that my country won't have died before I do. And that's why I went on with endless dedication to exposing things mainly to do with the European Union. I've never been much of a conspiracy theorist, but conspiracy fact has always interested me. Anybody who does not believe in conspiracies has never been in a children's playground.
Okay, so that's really what we're here to talk about today, which is this fascinating document, the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, which was masterminded by Walter Funk, who, the German economics minister under Adolf Hitler in 1942. Now, how did you first become aware of this?
I got to know about it via Chris Searle. I'd heard about
it. Who's he?
Well, I'd heard about it, but knew nothing of it. And then Christopher Searle, who was an economics and finance journalist with a very strong bent for investigative journalism, had written a number of very weighty tomes and had them published a magazine monthly, which he wrote himself, on global finance and the intrigues between countries. He wasn't very popular with countries because he exposed alliances when people were supposedly at loggerheads, and loggerheads when people were supposedly in alliance, and he was very good at it.
So what was his magazine?
I really can't remember the title. It's one of the joys of being my age and having had chemo. I have lots of holes in my memory nowadays, unfortunately. But being 77 this month, something was going to fall off, and it's bits of memory, I find, and recall of words. So look out for that.
Okay, so once you become aware of it through Chris Searle, how do we get to the situation where it... Sorry?
I used the wrong name. Chris Searle. Chris Story.
Oh, Christopher Story.
Yes.
Ah, because, he was prolific, wasn't he? And he used to produce all these
Soviet journals
finance stuff. My God. I mean, I think I even, I was looking at a copy the other day and thought, whatever happened to this guy? You know, he was publishing his and these were mini books, basically, regular that mini books he put out.
His books were that thick.
Okay. So Christopher Story, tell us a little bit more about him.
Christopher was fascinating. He was Eton educated. He'd virtually, as far as I can work out, spent his whole life. He was a little older than me, not much, but he'd spent his whole life independently. He also called his business Harl Publishing.
Can you spell that?
H-A-R-L, I think. I'm not sure.
Okay.
And it is in a couple of his books, the linkage, but he had written very much in depth about finance and the relationships that were going on between China and America and Russia and America. He wrote in depth about the economy of Russia, the structures of communism. His material was very erudite.
It could maybe be a good time to say something about this whole idea of China and the United States, because even though, of course, we're presented with these two antagonistic powers, superpowers, obviously, you know, which are squaring up for a third world war, there is a lot of evidence that, you know, there are big factions on both sides who are most definitely cooperating, exchanging ideas, technology, even a kind of vision for the future between the two. So, I mean, Christopher was onto that years ago.
Oh, he was writing about that back in the 60s in some detail. And I think the American president who set out to discover China, because America didn't recognize China, is probably the greatest explorer in America's history. And he opened the door publicly to China, who they've been dealing with all along. There was a certain animus between them, because Chiang Kai-shek, when he fled China to Formosa, Taiwan, had taken the Chinese piggy bank with him. And he knew that Mao would come after him, and Mao would not relent until he got his money back, because he was rather partial to his piggy bank. And don't forget that Mao Zedong had killed somewhere in the region of 50 million of his own people to get in command of that piggy bank. But Chiang Kai-shek was very clever, because he immediately took that money and he invested it in long-term bonds in America, which meant that the only way that Mao Zedong was going to get his money back was going to war with America, which would have been a bit of a major problem.
This is ironic as well, because we know that the Yale in China organization back in the 1920s had actually financed Mao's rise to power through his bookshop network. And there's a lot of evidence that Mao certainly didn't just rise up from China. He was helped by the Skull and Bones Society and by Yale University to actually get going.
Correct.
For the revolution.
But that is not unusual. When you think that America has been behind many of these conflicts worldwide, America, after the Second World War, did a great deal to destabilize the British Commonwealth. And it did it for the simple reason it couldn't understand why it had pitched up, albeit late, for a war, which had already been won by Britain. The problem was that...
By Russia? Sure, you said by the Soviet Union?
No. It had been won by Britain, but we had beaten Germany... And we'd beaten Germany because Germany...
Winning the Battle of Britain wasn't beating Germany, was it?
I didn't say it was. It was defending Britain. The Battle of Britain was all about defence. And at the time, it was the expedient move. The way we defeated Germany was quite simple. We bombed their railways to a standstill, which meant they couldn't get their fuel and munitions and food to the fighting fronts, and they had to find a new source of oil. And without that new source of oil, they had lost. And we had blocked their source of oil. So they went into Russia, and the only reason they went into Russia was to get to more oil. And the present German government hasn't twigged that it's only trying to do the same as it did last time, which is confront Russia for oil.
Okay, well, look, let's get back to Chris Story, because, I mean, if people have not come across him before, where's a good way to find him and get hold of his material?
If you put his name into the internet, you will come up with probably only my website. And my website has much, not all. I do have the rest, but it's hours in the day, of his website, which was closed when he died.
Well, it sounds like very valuable material. Are you happy for people to copy that and mirror it and other parts of the internet, that sort of thing?
Anything that I ever put on the internet is in the public domain. You may do with it what you wish. And I say that for two reasons. You will anyway. And I'm not into spending my lifetime in court losing money. And nor would I wish to confine the information. Anything I know, I am happy for the world to know. Furthermore, anything on any of my websites, I will stand by it. Totally. Anybody who reads something on one of my many websites will... who doesn't agree or believes they have facts that prove me wrong, please contact me. I will immediately amend it if you state who you are, confidentially, and what your source is, if it does, in my opinion, mean that I have made an error, I will change it. Please be advised, in over 20 years now on the internet, I have never been asked to alter a single solitary word of anything I've published in any material way. Yes, I make a lot of spelling mistakes.
Well, so it sounds to me as if you'd be accused of being a conspiracy theorist, but not actually pressed on any of the facts. That's the sort of thing that happens so often. Anyway, look, back to this document, Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft. It was effectively secret, wasn't it? Can you just let us know how it came to light? Take us through that whole process, because you've heard about it from Chris Story. You actually did something about it, didn't you? You just didn't think, oh, well, it's difficult to find it. We'll just give up.
I had, during that phase of my life, built up a lot of contacts. I started shopping around. I discovered that immediately the end of the war came, every copy of both editions, it was first published in 1942 and there was a second edition in 1943, every copy was bought or collated and collected to a a central point, and it was destroyed, a little akin to some of the Gospels of the Bible, which the Catholic Church has destroyed or withdrawn from circulation to be able to control what their doctrine is, as opposed to what may well be the truth. And it was not expedient for various powers that be to have people realize that in 1942, Walter Funk had foreign on behalf of Adolf Hitler and the Reich drawn up a document, Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, in other words, the European Union.
Well, no, that translates as European Economic Community.
Correct. In other words, the European Union. Well, they are one and the same thing. That is how the European Economic Community, and in making that correction, you are merely reverting to the name of the European Union prior to the arbitrary decision that was never voted on to change its name to European Union. Okay, so it was the European Economic Community.
The problem with this document is it's basically a smoking gun. Anything which was prepared by Adolf Hitler's economics minister, which is then actually brought to fruition by Hitler's enemies, is a bit of a, yeah, it's a bit of a smoking gun. So I remember having a chat with he was a Conservative Party member not sure which part of the country, but I met him down in Marlborough. He recounted a story with his uncle, Idris Evans, who was escorting a Nazi general at the Nuremberg trials in 1946. And it's not just hearsay. He sent me photographs of his uncle. He sent me his ticket to the Nuremberg trials as well. He had a pass to go in and out of them, where one of these Nazi generals said, "Yes, you have beaten us for the second time, but next time we will win and you won't know what's happening until it's all over." Now, this document, it really does flesh out that statement by that Nazi general. So how did you get hold of it? You know, there were a lot of people, very powerful people, trying to make sure that this document has been at the end of the Second World War. As these plans begin to be put into place, the Treaty of Rome, the EEC, the EU, as these plans start to roll out, everybody's aware that this is really important, that this document is erased from history, that it never happened.
I started out by contacting libraries in this country. I then tried the British Library. I had no success. I tried the Library of Congress. I had no success. I tried the Moscow Library and had no success. And in fact, the Moscow Library was incredibly helpful. They said I might find a copy in Kazakhstan. I tried Kazakhstan. I tried the other stans as well.
So how do you do that? Just by phone from Chepstow?
Pick up a telephone.
Yeah, okay.
You can phone anyone in the world if you want to.
Let your fingers do the walking when you want to get the smoking gun.
Yep. Indeed. I was then referred to the Ukraine by Kazakhstan, who thought they might have a copy because they were fairly closely allied parts of the Ukraine with the Nazi Germany, although that has worn off greatly. Yes, I'm sure there are still Nazi sympathizers. There are still homes in Germany where you can walk in and the picture over the mantelpiece, turn it around and look who's on the back of it, and it'll have a picture of Adolf Hitler, because people have allegiances that carry beyond dare I say, sanity. And they referred me to Berlin. Berlin Staatsbibliothek. And they said they were pretty certain they had a copy. So I got on to somebody who knew somebody who probably knew somebody who worked there. And I got the message back. Yes, they had a copy, but it was under lock and key. It was in what they called their reserve collection, which is not available without full license and permission, and that no one had ever drawn it. And I made further inquiries, and I'm afraid I'm going to leave out some of the detail here. I found somebody who acquired the pamphlets, all of them, because it was published in pamphlet format, not book format. And they borrowed them from the library and made photocopies of them and returned them when the library first opened in the morning.
Well, hang on, because if it's part of a reserve collection, you're not normally allowed to take those out.
As I said, I'm not going to go into too many details on that, but otherwise somebody might be able to track down how I got it, which would be very unfair on the people who assisted the world to know of this document.
Okay, so what year roughly were you up to this?
That was in about 1998. I can't remember, to be honest, but it was around then. And I had had my computer destroyed electronically. I'm not sure who by, but one of the experts, and I mean expert, he had about 4 or 5 degrees in including computer technology, and was the director of a major international computer company. And he spent 4 days trying to repair my computer. And he said, this has been done professionally at the highest level. I cannot repair it. There is an organization which is about 30-odd miles from here, that has specialists at doing this sort of thing. And I have my suspicions who and how. Anyway.
The other side of the seven.
Yes. Far be it from me to accuse anybody. However, I can understand why they did. And I let this be known to a few friends. My computer had been trashed. And mysteriously, within 2 days, a computer was delivered, brand new, an upgrade from somebody who said, had you been fighting this hard as a Spitfire pilot a few years back and your plane had been shot down, you would have had a few days off and been given a new Spitfire. Keep up the good work. And that's all it said. To this day, I have no idea who donated it.
So why do you think, I mean, this is about the significance of this Europäischen Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft document. Why do you think so much, I mean, it maybe had nothing to do with that, but it could easily have done. What's the significance of that document today?
I know that the individual involved, because there was also a note with it, if you need it translated, let me know. I didn't know who it was. He phoned me up and he said, I'll send somebody in to collect it. And I thought, well, he's just given me a computer. Nobody else knows I got it. It was collected from me, the pamphlets. I had made another photocopy of them. And just to be on the safe side, because it could be that same organisation just over the Severn who had thought of a clever way of getting it back. Shortly afterwards, it came back, fully translated into English. I published it together with a friend of mine, Mark Oliver, on a website called Silent Majority. It is still on the internet there, though Silent Majority has become a little obscured in that it's got so much material on it. And it's in the old version of Silent Majority, which is still live, but you have to dig around to find it.
Don't try finding it on Google. But anyway, but what I'm trying to say is the significance of it today. I mean, my own work has been looking at, particularly at, I suppose, the historical record, the published historical record on the idea of a Fourth Reich, the idea of a, basically set out by two people specifically. First of all, in the 1990s, this book Op JB was published by Christopher Crichton, a.k.a. John Ainsworth Davis, who talks about the Ian Fleming and himself going to pick up Hitler's private secretary and treasurer, Martin Bormann, from Berlin under the noses of the Russians right at the end of the Second World War, bringing them by canal, delivering them over to a chap called Desmond Morton, who was Churchill's private secretary. The figure of Bormann being so important was that, I mean, literally he was the signatory on the bank accounts of the loot of Europe over the previous 5 or 6 years. And then there was Paul Manning, who published actually before, but he looked into Bormann's activities down in South America, setting up these 750 companies, then laundering this money through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, investing that money into those businesses, putting ex-Nazis in charge of those businesses and Nazi sympathisers from around the world in charge of those businesses. But one of the key things was many of those companies were, it was deliberate that they put Jews as the chairman, so that would be there to basically disguise the fact that it was a Nazi business. So I wonder how this links in maybe with this Fourth Reich idea of Bormann's.
I think, delving into history a little, do remember that President Bush, the first President Bush, his father was Prescott Bush. Prescott Bush was an American banker who funded the Nazi Party. If that sounds a little extreme, do bear in mind that the Pilgrim Fathers' founders in America, who run their company to this day with many of the same mores, is IBM. And IBM provided the computer equivalent of its day in terms of records, recording people.
And it was these old punch card machines, the Hollerith machines.
Yes, yeah. Those records were used to record the Jewish citizens who could be picked out from the punch cards to go and march through the gates of Arbeit macht frei. Furthermore, these linkages continue. They also provided the punch card system for the French Vichy government, of which you may remember President Mitterrand, who worked very closely with Klaus Barbie to deport French citizens to Germany as part of the final solution.
Well, look, if people don't know much about Barbie, he was the butcher of Lyon, who then went over to Brazil to advise and run the intelligence services for the Brazilians after the war.
He had spent the whole time, as when he was a fugitive in France, being protected by the Catholic Church. Very protected by the Catholic Church and residual members like Mitterrand in the Vichy government. But then again, do remember that the Polish Pope was a salesman prior to being in the race for the papacy. He was a salesman for a chemical company, the very same chemical company, and at the very same time that was supplying Cyclone B to Auschwitz.
Okay, so at the moment we've got this week the World Economic Forum meeting over in Davos. Unfortunately for them, it's not very snowy. There's been not much snow this year, so there actually might be protests. This is, I think, quite a sneaky way of running a conference of the world's financial elite, where you make sure that there's not going to be protests going on, because if protesters turn up and try and sleep in a tent, they'll probably be dead in the morning. It'll be so cold up there. But we all know about the World Economic Forum. Lots of people certainly are onto their game, which is basically, through a hostile takeover bid with the United Nations, starting to finance the, you know, the world's governance, if you want. More interestingly, though, we've got some information now about the Bilderberg meeting coming up in the spring, which is going to be in Lisbon. Do you want to say something about the World Economic Forum and the Bilderbergers and how they relate to each other?
I'm going to keep this very simple, otherwise we'll be producing a recording that will take you the next 10 years to edit it. The World Economic Forum started visibly in about 1971, started by Klaus Schwab, mystery individual, no consequence, who the hell's he, ignore it, let it, and it got going. Of course, Klaus Schwab, his father was an SS general. Interestingly, his mother was one of the Rothschild sisters. So where that squares the circle for the final solution, I'm not quite sure. But let us look a little further. Currently, the World Economic Forum seems to be, and I know it is, but seems to be behind a young woman called Greta Thunberg. How does she seem to be? Well, the family industry of Greta Thunberg's ancestors, as far as I can trace it back, goes back to around 1900. And her father, Svante, is his prename. He's never really had a job. He's been a bit of a bit actor, just as his wife, Greta's mother, has been a sometime minor opera singer. However, they are very wealthy. So start digging a little, and you will find Greta Thunberg's ancestors. Her grandfather is very well known. I will leave it to you to dig just in case I find myself using the wrong spelling which were of the name, I might well then find myself in court. It's very easy to trace. This goes back further.
I think you're going to have to tell us a bit more than that. Otherwise, you know, I'm at a loss. I can't use that sort of thing, you know.
No. Because I'm about to fill in.
Okay.
I'm about to fill in very briefly. There is a relationship between Schwab and her grandfather, which you will be able to trace with ease. I have it on my website, so panic not about it. The details are there to find. It's just that, as I've already said, I have holes in my memory on these things.
Well, you can remember your website address. What's that?
My website is most readily found. My websites are most readily found by going to www.info-web-site-site.uk. When you get there, you'll probably come up on home page. You'll probably find that the powers that be will say that this is infected, it's got spyware, etc. No, it hasn't. But they don't much like you reading my material. And if you go to the page that says Websites All, scan down there, you will find a huge number of different sites where you can research everything from Freemasonry to the Speculative Society of Edinburgh to Common Purpose to the new, to the World Economic Forum and much more besides.
Okay, look, let's wind up, though. I did ask you about the Bilderbergers. They're a fascinating organisation, having been chaired for the first 20 years, from the 50s to the mid-70s, by a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, although people didn't realise, maybe many of them at the time, that he was ex-SS. And they do seem to be very closely associated with the NATO countries. In fact, some would say, and I would be one of them, they pretty much control, they certainly steer, they almost control the political parties in the NATO countries. So what do you make of them? Because they are also tied in with this whole idea of a European unification and the idea of a United States of Europe.
And so, of course, it's the CIA who wanted to see a European Union and used the Bilderbergers and supported the Bilderbergers. And it's called the Bilderbergers because it's named after the Bilderberg Hotel in the Netherlands.
Oosterbeek, just outside Arnhem.
Correct. And let us never forget that for every member of the Dutch resistance who supported Britain, there were five wearing grey uniforms during the last war. Holland and, as with Austria, neither were classified as Nazi countries, but they were very Nazified. And they have worked, and they've been working closely with the World Economic Forum and Schwab, etc. They have interchangeable positions, so that if one of them is getting rather too much bad publicity through, let us say, the Bilderberg meetings, well, all of a sudden, the same people don't go as noticeably to the Bilderberg meetings. They turn up at the Davos meeting. But you referred to the weather in Davos this year. Apparently, one of the really thriving things about Davos this year is the sex workers in Davos have never been so busy. which indicates the morality of the type of individuals who go to these meetings. The strange thing is that the World Economic Forum, literally thousands of private jets flew in for the Davos meeting. We're talking of big deal to control us, fraud that it is, mankind causing global climate change, which of course there isn't a shred of scientific provenance for, not one shred, nor is there a single shred, and I revert back to Greta Thunberg's great-great-great-grandfather, after whom her father is named, Svante, who was a member of the Nobel Committee. And in 1903, he was granted a Nobel Prize. Now, bear in mind, the Nobel Prize is about, in its year, about the equivalent of £1 million. So it's not to be sneezed at. He was granted the Nobel Prize for inventing the term global warming and defining the measurement of exactly how much carbon dioxide there was in the atmosphere and exactly how much additional carbon dioxide needed to go into the atmosphere to raise the world's temperature by 1.5 degrees on average. Now, interestingly, there was no form of instrumentation available to man or beast in 1903 that could measure the amount of a given gas in the world atmosphere. Secondly, there was no possibility of being able to measure how many more tons or what percentage of the global atmosphere would have to be provided to get an extra 1.5 degrees on the planet. It was a total fraud, but it has been a family industry that has greatly enriched the family ever since. Now, if you field a young girl in pigtails who happens to be diminutive even for her age, reading a script provided by her minders, and her most visible one, who is standing by her virtually at every single photograph that's ever taken of her, happens to work for the World Economic Forum and has done since she left school, you start to realise what's happening. We are being manipulated.
Well, yes, we certainly are. Propaganda on a massive scale. But look, just this week, when Greta Thunberg was arrested in Germany, it just so happened that the camera rehearsal for the arrest was leaked. So they showed that they were actually getting ready to film the arrest, but they didn't actually... It wasn't actually a genuine situation. This was all prepared for the public. Your use of television is incredible. Anyway, look, you're describing here really something that I've been tracking, Greg, for a long time too, which is the rise of a kind of a gangster state. It's almost as if the... I'm thinking about really the EU here as a gangster state specifically. But a gangster planet. The sort of thing that our grandparents fought against in the 1940s and thought they banished. The question's got to be, what do we do about this?
What we do about it is we make sure that we don't let cancer or a heart attack grab us, and we publicise it at every single possible occasion. This particular interview goes into far too much detail for most people, because most people look at it, and yes, the World Economic Forum has some of the best PR agents in the world, and they write glowing terms of how wonderful what they're doing is. But do bear in mind, hidden in plain sight is Klaus Schwab, who has openly stated to entire meetings in front of such media as they invite, i.e. the ones who are paid lackeys, and he makes statements like, we are making great progress. We now have the majority of world leaders at our meeting, and we have members of their central government and cabinets who are our supporters, who we have over the years been able to put in place. Why do you think we saw the debacle of the leadership challenge winding up with an unelected prime minister who had worked for an international bank and then for one of the biggest hedge funds in Britain, and his chancellor, unelected appointee, who has a Chinese wife, who lives in Belgium, whose sister works in China, who is forever quoting China. Why do you think this is happening when the membership of the Tory party very clearly and unequivocally voted against him when they had the opportunity and voted for Liz Truss, who was brought down by the lackey media who are working in cahoots with the big banks, who are all tied straight back into the World Economic Forum?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the whole business with Boris, which is what you're alluding to there, is that his popularity rating was something like, even despite Partygate, which was a big fuss in the press, but his actual popularity rating amongst potential Tory voters was something like 60% still, whereas Liz Truss, I think, was 18% and Rishi Sunak 20%. So the Conservative Party, by having this leadership discussion debate, by forcing Boris out, which was actually Rishi Sunak that led the revolt against Boris Johnson, seems to have put the Conservative Party in an unelectable position now.
Rishi Sunak was working for his masters.
But the question was, what do we do about it?
The question is, make sure as many people as possible know. And whenever you can, read about it. Don't close your mind and say, oh, it's a conspiracy theory, because every single fact that I have given you today is provable on paper. We have banned, for instance, we have effectively banned the use of coal in Britain. However, interestingly, on this world lead we have given that are the liars amongst the fraudsters who are selling this scam about climate, they've never mentioned, have they, that they closed down Drax as a coal burning power plant in Britain. So now they're cutting down virgin forest in Canada and North America and feeding it into a chipper machine, which they then haul across from the west coast of America to the east coast of America, load onto ships, and then ship it over to Britain, where 17 trainloads of it a week are taken to Drax. It takes 21 days from cutting the tree down to delivering it to Drax. Drax is using green energy. Yeah, it's chopping up loads of green trees, using a huge amount of green heavy fuel oil, and so on.
This is described very well, this whole kind of fake green, greenwash in the Michael Moore film, Planet of the Humans. Very, very good film. Absolutely, of course, not shown on television, obviously, but he explains very well. It's actually not Michael Moore on screen, but he was involved in the production of it. Mm-hmm. Planet of the Humans, if you've not seen it, please. I mean, it shows you just what a lie this is. But look, one thing you've sort of missed out, Greg, if you don't mind me saying, is Putin and Russia.
I've left him out at the moment because he's very contentious and there's a great deal of argument going on.
We're not afraid of that sort of thing.
But there is no doubt that he is firmly on record. He wrote a 5,000-word essay 10 or 11 years ago, a polemic on how he would re-establish the Russia of Peter the Great. And his attack on the Ukraine has been directly in that direction. However, it does seem very likely that he is something of an old man in a hurry, which is why he's made mistake after mistake. But his mistakes are very dangerous because he, being an old man in a hurry in terms of his health, he has nothing to lose if he finds eventually, and it dawns on him, he is not going to win in the Ukraine. He has nothing to lose to press a nuclear button.
Well, hang on, because they pretty much have one in the Ukraine now. Their stated objective is to reclaim these Lugansk and, well, the Donbass, basically, these two oblasts in eastern Ukraine. They clearly want to push back. I don't think the objective is to stop Ukraine existing. It's to, first of all, they call it denazification, and it's quite clear there are Nazi rallies going on in Ukraine. If people bother to look, you will see them and find them. Speeches, you know, around the Stefan Bandera and the Nazis. Absolutely, 100%, of course, it's race hate against the Slavs, the Russians. And the key thing, really, to understand about what's happening in Ukraine, surely, is that the Russians aren't doing just an invasion of Ukraine. They're doing something which is designed to push the basically to retake the Russian-speaking areas in Ukraine and then to have a new border.
The Donbass wasn't a Russian-speaking area. It was made a Russian-speaking area by Russia, moving in huge numbers of Russian speakers.
In the Soviet era?
Hmm?
In the Soviet era?
Right up until this war broke out. They were still moving people. And in 2014, the agreement of that time wasn't agreed by anybody. It was announced by Russia, and a great number of politicians at the time thought, what the hell? And Russia got away with achieving it. However, the Ukrainian people resented it, and despite the Soviet removing an awful lot of those Ukrainian people from the Donbass area and moving in yet more Russian speakers. They have claimed they've conquered the Donbass and taken it back. I would contend, have they? Hell. Because all one has to do is look at exactly how much love is lost between the Ukraine and Russia. Look at the Holodomor, which was the deliberate genocide by the Soviet Union under Stalin, in which approximately 4 million people were killed in the Ukraine by putting 750,000 Russian troops into the Ukraine and seizing the entirety of their grain output and moving it to Russia to feed the Russian people, because Stalin's agricultural policy had failed abysmally.
This was called a famine, wasn't it?
And it was called a famine, but it was a genocide.
Actually, you could say the same about Ireland, actually, in the 1800s.
No, you couldn't. Because the main people who perpetrated the problem in the 1800s were as a result of the potato famine. And that was brought about by two things. But bear in mind a third. The British government had been telling the Irish farmers, for God's sake, rotate your crops, because you are planting potatoes, and after that potatoes, and then again potatoes, and you're living on a diet of potatoes, and you are stripping the nitrogen out of the soil, and you are going to weaken the potato. The next thing that happened was that Britain was importing potatoes from America, and had done for quite some time. And a ship opened its cargo hold as it was coming into the lanes of Liverpool, off the coast, about 3 miles out off the coast of Ireland, and they discovered they had a rotten crop in the hold. The whole lot was alive with Colorado beetle, which are little black beetles with yellow spots, or is it little yellow beetles with black spots? I've never met one. And so they couldn't take that on into Liverpool. So they hoofed the whole lot over the side, sluiced out their hold, and went into Liverpool to pick up a return cargo to pay for their voyage. It would appear that one of these potatoes at least floated into Ireland with a beetle on it. That led to the spread of Colorado beetle amongst the weakened potatoes of Ireland. Also, the Irish landlords of Irish origin found they led a better life in the court of St. James. And in order to subsidise that, they found that the price of their crops on their estates in Ireland was higher in Liverpool, Bristol and London at market. And they started to ship their crops out of Ireland to Britain.
A bit like shipping the grain out of Ukraine into Russia.
Absolutely the same. And they shipped it out, except that there, with Russia, it was to feed the Soviet people in Russia who were dying of starvation due to the stupidity of Stalin's agricultural policy.
It didn't have a market system in the Soviet Union.
Correct. However, the crops from Ireland were going out specifically to fund what we would now call nowadays the remittance men amongst the elite of the Irish who were living in London. And in fact, it reached the stage where the Irish were having problems getting and attacking the convoys of food that were going out of Ireland. And under the law, you had free passage of safe passage of goods and people on the King's Highway. And it ended up with British black and tans escorting the food that was being shipped out. Net result, it was because it became folklore that the British stole their food. Did we? Hell. One, but it's a good myth. Two, the British Crown was actually purchasing the crop when it got to market in Britain, Liverpool, London, and Bristol, and they were shipping that crop they had purchased back to Ireland.
Well, look, these merchants have got a lot to answer for. They kind of took over after the English Civil War. But back to today, to Ukraine, what do you make of where it's going? Because that's, I think, a good way to end is just to look at where you think this particular conflict might be heading.
I think that the Soviet Union will not win.
The Soviet Union doesn't exist.
It does. Belarus is part of it. It's just very
It's the Russian Federation, isn't it? It's not certainly not a Soviet system. It's it's an alliance, but it's not Soviet, not the Soviet system.
That's not how Mr. Putin sees it.
Well, hang on, Peter the Great. It wasn't a Soviet system either.
I know.
If he is trying to emulate Peter, I mean, he may be saying by talking about Peter the Great, he may just be simply saying, you know, pre the Russian Revolution. That's what he's interested in. He thinks Russia was actually, a successful state and empire pre the revolution, and he wants to go back to that. And in fact, he may even be talking about the country's Orthodox roots, Orthodox Church.
Well, one of the major problems he's got with the Orthodox Church, which is why they have a major problem with the Ukraine. During the time of communism, God-based religions were suppressed. And just as it is utterly stupid of the Western world to try to force what we call democracy on Muslim countries, because whatever the politicians decide, the mullahs will make the decision on a Friday night. And that is what will pertain as the law. And democracy does not feature in that. It is run by diktat, more or less, to the standards of Sharia law. And at the end of the day, we have the same problem with Russia. Russia, when the Soviet Union, at the end of the Cold War, was dismantled, permitted the reintroduction of various types of God-bothering. Obviously, one of the greatest of those was the Russian Orthodox Church. It then becomes expedient to realize that much the same as the mullahs dictating to the politicians in Muslim countries, the seat of the Russian Orthodox Church is in Kiev. And so they are actually heavily involved across the border with an independent country.
Well, they've completely split the two. And anyway, the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church is in Moscow.
Yes. However, the head office is, in reality, in Kiev.
So what you're saying is that Kiev is somehow running the Russian Orthodox Church? I thought there'd been quite a serious split between the two after the coup, effectively, the 2014 coup.
Yes, but they also split the papacy at one stage. But the Pope, before that, ended up going out of his way to destroy the new papacy.
Well, that was a bit of a rabbit hole. Let's get back to where you think this conflict in Ukraine is going, because it seems pretty serious, and it could be very long drawn out. Some people saying that it actually may only last for another maybe 6 months, a year, and there'll be a new border draw.
I personally do not think at this stage, having lost 30,000 or between 20 and 40,000 Russian troops, plus the number of Russian civilians they've managed to kill so far, and having killed an awful lot of Ukrainians, I don't think this is going to be a peace where they will be able to share land or a common decision. And I personally don't think that Russia is going to be able to sustain its losses in terms of its absolute failure to get anything of benefit for Russia out of it, other than the kudos of a brick demolition yard, because they have reduced the Donbas to a demolition site.
I think we're probably ultimately concerned more with the UK. We've got a Goldman Sachs Prime Minister right now who's running the Tory party into the ground, and quite clearly the City of London have decided that Keir Starmer is going to be their man. Wes Streeting, you know, these Labour Party people, it's their turn now. Is there anything we can do about all this?
Well, I think we're in the difficult position that Churchill named. Democracy is an appalling form of government, but it's the best form we know of. And we're in a position where the Tory government is about as popular as a pork chop in a synagogue. The only thing more unpopular is the Marxist government of the Labour Party. So I don't think it's quite as black and white as the media might lead you to believe. I believe that there will be something of a miracle pulled out of a hat to keep the Tories in power because of the awesome catastrophe of having a Labour government.
Well, why do you say that? Yeah.
The catastrophe is quite simple. There is no record in Britain of ever having a Labour government that didn't leave the country bankrupt. Never. Their economic policies are little short of lunacy. And what you have to remember about them is that time and time again, they leave the country with no money in the exchequer.
Well, hang on, a minute, because the Tories have doubled. We're now at something like 1.7 trillion national debt.
On that point, it's more complex than just looking at past Labour governments. Past Labour governments have always taken over when the economy has been fairly healthy and the politics have been fairly stable. This time, whoever is the government after the next election will in fact have a poison chalice, because the country has never owed as much money in its entire history. And if a Labour government comes into power, what the hell will they use for money? There isn't any spare. And they're not very good at managing money, as proven by the fact that they sold off $132 billion privatising the health service when they were last in government, except they called it PFI. Well, and PFI is going to end in about 2050, by which time that $132 billion will have turned into between $450 and $500 billion that we've paid for a privatised health service. Thank you very much, Mr Blair and Mr Brown. Now, we don't want a repeat of that.
Well, no, and you're painting a very obvious picture of a bankrupt Westminster. If Westminster's bankrupt, who's going to take over from it?
It's quite simple, really. Britain isn't bankrupt for as long as it's trusted on the world stage. It's like turning round and looking at Wales that wants independence. Well, what a wonderful idea that is. They have no currency. They have no money with which to pay off their share of the national debt. They have no income. They have no exports. And flight of employment from the Welsh region has been massive. And we're in a position that if it became independent, it would have no credit rating on the world stage and no one would lend it any money. Whereas Britain has never, in the long term, defaulted on a debt.
Well, that's in the days of industry. Now we've got nothing.
Now we've got nothing because, in the main, Tony Blair and the Green Agenda lobbyists have exported all our jobs on the absolute fraud of climate change. We are currently, as a planet, going to be burning somewhere in the region of 8 billion tonnes of coal during 2023. That is more than any other year in the history of the planet. And let's take that one step further. China and India will be burning the majority of this. Tata in Bombay will be burning coal like there's no tomorrow to produce steel to export to Britain. Because we've exported our steel industry to Tata Industries.
Well, look, you were just having a pop at the Orthodox Church, but what about... I mean, this is all beginning to sound quite apocalyptic, isn't it?
Did I say it wasn't? We have the four riders of the apocalypse living amongst us. And we actually now have a fifth one. It's called the Green Lobby. They are the fourth riders of the apocalypse. Net zero is an utter crock of rubbish. Bear in mind, we have a commodity called oil, which is the great sinner.
Or coal, even greater.
No. Oil, because coal... I'll come to coal if you want me to. But coal, don't forget, solar panels... can only be made using huge amounts of coal, because coal is the only thing that will heat silicon up to convert to glass to 1800 degrees and maintain it there for nearly an hour. You cannot do that with any other fuel. So all our solar panels are using far more coal to make them than they could possibly save. We would be better off burning the coal to do the job. When it comes to the steel, we would be better off making our own steel for what we need it for in Britain with our own coal. And when it comes to cement, it would be so much better to be using our own cement rather than exporting the job to Nigeria and using huge amounts of heavy fuel oil, shipping it back here, and then actually looking at oil, which is claimed to be a fossil fuel. There are no fossils below 16,000 feet on this planet underground. None. There is no scientific record of them of any description. However, the overwhelming bulk of the oil, heavy fuel oil and crude, comes from between 30 and 35,000 feet underground. Not a fossil in sight, mate. It is a complete myth to call oil a fossil fuel.
So what is it then?
Nobody really knows. It's occurring in the magma, and we can't actually work out what it is because it's occurring under hugely high pressure, some 30,000 feet underground, at a very high temperature. As soon as you stick a drill into it, the pressure goes. And getting samples up to the surface, it isn't the same stuff once it's up here as it was when it was down there. And let me refer you to a commodity which it may be very similar to. Look up snotite. Yes, it's spelt exactly as it sounds. Snotite was discovered in a cave system in limestone and actually gives a bit of a lie to the fact that all caves are caused by water erosion, because snotite is a literally somewhat snotty slime that's found in these caves. But you can't really investigate the caves without full hazmat equipment, because it is incredibly, and I can't remember which I should do, alkaline or acidic. So much so that you can't go in there without being fully suited. And this, it transpires, is a microorganism that eats rock. There are many things on this planet that we do not understand.
Well, hopefully a visit to your website will mean a few more are understood. Can you just remind us of whereabouts to find you, Greg?
You can find my websites collectively under Websites All when you get there, but look up www.infowebsite.uk.
Okay, Greg Lance Watkins, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.